How many of you have ever been poetry slammed? Huh? Applaud if you've been slammed. Okay. In my day, poets and so forth didn't slam one another. I can't imagine Emily Dickinson really at a slam, but it's possible. But this is a whole new genre here, and it's we actually have the Madison's National Poetry Slam team, or two members of it anyhow, and this is like a national competition, right, that you go into. And actually, let me just talk to them for a minute over here, so we get to set this up here. We've got David Hart, Caitlin McGahan, is that right? Yes, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks.
See you.
Well, thank you.
You're well, and she's good. Okay, that's good. For people who are unfamiliar with slamming altogether, what sort of competition is it? I mean, what is involved in a slam, poetry slam?
It is the competitive art of poetry. And really, slam poetry was started to make poetry accessible to everyone. Started in a bar in Chicago. It blends performance with writing, and really that's what it is. We take five judges from the audience, and it's sort of an Olympic-styled judging after a lot of drinking. But it's...
Does that at all affect the judging, the amount of drinking? Then?
It actually makes the poetry better. I hear.
How did you start with it?
Well, my day job is an assistant attorney general, I've always been a... that's enough to make you do poetry. I get it.
You find yourself doing poetry during the course of your job.
It's easier to do poetry than to write legal briefs sometimes. But I started out as a hip hop artist, and when I was 14, 15, and it got harder to explain to the family why I needed to leave for hip hop, and it's easier to say that I'm leaving for poetry.
Caitlin, pretty much same story for you.
Yeah, same story.
Attorney General and all the rest.
Right. Yes. It's a tough
pop.
Right. Yes. But no, I've been writing for a long time, and was invited to share it on stage, and it's just been a really fun element to add to it, the performance piece.
Is there any like I know people I know who do write poetry or write verse? I guess you could say. It's usually for them it's like a private thing. So this is kind of like a major breakthrough where you're actually out there shouting it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot of guts to hop up on stage and share what, you know, I've kept in my journals for so long. So I mean, it's fun. We have a great crowd and everybody's really welcoming and supportive. But it's a lot of fun.
Excellent. Now we can get an example or one or two examples here. And what is the procedure now that you're going to show us? I mean, how does this contest work?
The contest works that there are two rounds a night for slam. Again, we get five judges from the audience, and they judge a 3-minute poetry of original construction, 0 to 10 based on the content of the poem as well as the performance. And tonight is a piece, this evening or afternoon is a piece from Caitlin and myself.
Okay, all right. So who begins and how does that? You take the mic and do your magic.
Valentine's Day did not begin with love or chocolate or Cupid or cards. It began with martyrs. No sappy sweet commercials, no icing or rocks adorn their hands, no societal pressures to be happy, sexy, conjuring a modern-day Aphrodite to provide the best Valentine's Day ever with the most perfect gift, outfit, or man. And if you didn't have those things, no maid of soul or one from the corner bar, then you're fated to be unseen. It's all or nothing this nowadays Valentine's scene, but it began with martyrs. And you know a little bit about that. Maybe not the lions in the Colosseum because you survived, but you know what it's like to be eviscerated, what it's like to be fed your own heart, to have a crushed spine. You know a little about sacrifice. For more than a decade plus longer, you've strapped on the armor like Joan of Arc. You charge to the front lines, but you don't hear angels. You hear ghosts and fire, and you're burning, burning, burning up inside. While others fret to find the most perfect gift, you're worried about that door, that gateway that allows your waking hell to be served up on a plate of roses, the thorns cut so deep they make your tears fall back into yourself as you drown your lungs in salt and rage, another year notched on his belt. Like wild turkey, you take the quick shots of people's compliments with an internal wince and that slow burn, and you feel like a chicken. Not like one that's waiting across the road. I'm talking yellow belly chicken that slinks around because they don't think they have the right to stand up. I'm talking gutless, no nothing. No wonder you only ever got flowers from him only one other time, and you questioned if you're worthy of such kindness, decided you weren't, so the flowers made you want to throw up because prior to that, only he gave you flowers to remind you that you were nothing. Cold, dead inside. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust every year. He places flowers on the headstone of your childhood. Every year, he tries to tell you that you're nothing, that you don't exist. But you know you're better than that. Like Mother Teresa, you bathe your wounds and give strength to your soul. You will never give up. You will keep fighting, and you'll end up wearing that lion for a cloak, just like Hercules did.
This is a piece that I wrote as I was trying to understand our current governor's position. And I'm not trying to be funny. I had to visualize what, or just meditate on what he must have been thinking about the people here in Madison as he came in to make his changes. And so this is it. And so they tell me that this is what democracy looks like. One pathetic, rusty mic, a broken down amp, and two dingy speakers. Donated by some college cover band who still rehearses in their mother's basement while a few thousand dirty, misguided hippies dance barefoot around a drum circle, channeling the 40s or the 60s or whenever the heck they thought they were cool and relevant, calling for the replacement of the only sane thing left in this godforsaken city. You know, I actually used to pity people like you. People who use democracy like it's the punchline of some unfunny joke you tell at your cocktail parties or your hemp rallies or carelessly. The way you casually compare anyone who doesn't agree with your politics to Hitler or some other fascist dictator. You know, democracy used to mean something greater than this. It was a higher calling, and I hold out hope that we can pull democracy from your death grip. I honestly do, but as I stand here, staring out my window, watching you behave like children in and on this hallowed space, it makes me reminisce for a time in our country where democracy actually denoted selflessness and self-sacrifice. Where the price of democracy wasn't just a few dollars taken from your already bloated paycheck, you could just file a grievance with your union boss over it. It meant freedom or death. It meant hunkering down in fields of the new country ripe with pneumonia and frostbite and fighting until your last breath. And then fighting on just a little bit longer until there were no more tears or blood to shed, no more rallies to have, and no more slogans or songs to write. It meant having to fight guerrilla style, outnumbered, outgunned, outmanned, but never outclassed against the forces of British colonialism and tyranny. See, when I was young, my mother explained to me, that democracy, true American democracy, was created by a few good men, God-fearing men, who sat in the back of clandestine Boston taverns, rolling out the Magna Carta like it was bread dough. And baking them and cutting them into unequal and even uneven pieces and baking them and packaging them into parcels to give to Paul Revere, who would risk his life riding them at night by horse straight to Ronald Reagan, who would in turn shake my hand and entrust those very same packages of democracy both to Jesus and me. And so you see, I really am on a mission from God. And I don't mean mission from God like I'm the Blues Brothers or mission from God because I'm the son of a Baptist preacher, but I mean mission from God like I'm the Apostle Paul, falling off his horse, riding on the way to Damascus mission. See, I'm the only one who's brave enough and courageous enough to do what must be done. That's to save the world and to protect the world from you. So you can just pull out your incense and your hemp. You can sing Kumbaya all you want with Lady Forward. You can take shots at me. You can call me a criminal all you want. You can take shots at my family. But you can't tell me that this is what democracy looks like.
All right, so we got the personal and the political here. Pretty good. And is that pretty much the way it breaks down in terms of an actual slant?
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything from Star Trek movies and physics to very personal to funny to spiritual and political, it follows a very long continuum and line. Absolutely.
Now, and for example, if you when you get up and do this, is there improvisation? And like, if someone following you thought what you said was, let's say, a crock,
sure,
and they wanted to respond to it in terms of what you were saying about maybe something that they were or they believed in, could they come up and improvise a response? Is that how it works in terms of a?
Sure, sure. That whole piece was improvisation. I was responding to her. Yeah, sure.
It's all about Valentine's Day. Boy, did I get that wrong.
Of course. There are some very talented poets on the national scene who make it their business to be responsive to pieces that they hear in a national slam.
But is that how it generally works? Or you do prepared pieces as opposed to improvisation?
Almost always prepared pieces, but in your sort of toolbox of pieces as a team, if you hear a piece and you hear that the crowd has reacted favorably or not favorably, you send up your person to do this piece or that piece or a team piece or whatever.
Excellent.
Sure.
Excellent. Yeah. Do we have time? You want to do another little piece, each of you?
I have no problem doing another piece. We brought an actual team member. I'm an organizer this year. We could certainly do another piece.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that we get our website out. Sure. Yeah. Shameless plugging. www.urbanspokenword.org. Mm-hmm. And we meet every third Saturday of the month at Jenna's Lounge right now.
Yeah.
And we're sending the team away in August. But we're having a fundraiser for them on the 14th at, what is it called, Washington Square Hotel.
Yeah.
Cafe.
Okay.
Sure.
Lakeside Vibers.
Sure.
Did you want someone on the team to do? Or are you?
Yes.
Come on. Who do we have here?
Tony Fudge.
Come on up, Tony. See if you got a response to what David. So. Maybe he was in that crowd. He was in that crowd. You're talking.
That's right. He'll be Newt Gingrich or something.
How you doing?
Good.
Okay. Floor is yours.
Floor is mine? Okay. It's a very long, strong apple that I use when I have an itch. Too many times do I puff out my bicycle and squeeze my fire hydrant. As I watch you try to hold your salmon, when you release, it's like an explosion of confetti. I've never experienced anything as majestic as your amazing silverware. The heavens and the earth conspired when they made your vinegar. Even though you somersault, I still believe in the power of toothpicks. Because there's a fire that lingers inside my bongo that makes my powder pity-pat. So never crease my Applejacks unless you want your hedgehog hacksawed. Because I would pack a pistol for any Peter Pipers that get a hankering for pickled peppers. In other words, I'd wield a weed whacker for any dangling dandelions dancing around your dipping dots. Because you are not only my longitude, my latitude, my lilacs, my lily pads, but you're my lunch meat. Thank you.
Yes! Thank you, guys. from the Madison National Poetry Slam Team. Thank you, Tony, Caitlin. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.